This is the Liminalista podcast between I'm Jason Horsley, and this week I am talking to Alexander Adams, the author of Culture War. There's a rock inside my chest. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, I was late because I literally couldn't put your book down. I mean, I thought I would have plenty of time to finish it this morning. Oh. But because of my sleep being interrupted, I didn't. And I didn't know anything about Comicsgate, which is odd because I used to be a comics fan, and even this latest book I've just finished about Hollywood, I end by writing about superhero movies and stuff, and somehow I hadn't heard about Comicsgate. So because you ended on that, I found. I just couldn't put it down. So that's very interesting. I don't know why it was I hadn't heard about that, because I think
you would have to go to specialist publications, and then it's just a subject that comes up every now and again when they're taking on comic skaters. I don't think the industry likes to talk about it very much, because a lot of the criticisms sort of cut to the bone to do with bad sales practice, the way the companies have done the comic stores down, the hostility of creators and so forth. So they try not to mention Comicsgate very much.
Hmm. Well, since we did start on that, since your book ended on that and we've just started on that, maybe let's just start there with an example of what your book's about and what it's addressing, because that certainly will be familiar to most people, I think. But you frame it in this very specific way, which was quite compelling, as the cultural entryism. Yes. Social justice activism is a kind of Trojan horse for trying to enter into the culture or colonize it and find secure positions within it. So do you want to just talk a little bit about that Comicsgate as an example of that part of your thesis?
Yeah. Basically, Comicsgate was a consumer reaction against perceived strange changes in the canon. Strange changes to character, the gender swapping and race swapping of characters. And this isn't just the roles, this is also the characters themselves. And there was this sort of perception that that heterosexuality had been sort of snuffed out or moved to the side, that there was a large number of androgynous figure designs. You also had an apparent favoritism towards lesbianism, and you have the Iceman being turned gay, which didn't really accord with his established character, as I understand it. And people began to complain about this, and there was a lot of talk about this. And this sort of built up on YouTube mainly, because a lot of the forums and the comment sections were patrolled already by activists or people sympathetic towards activism. So the only outlet that was not censored was YouTube. And so you had the foundation of channels like Comics Matter, which was originally called Diversity and Comics, Yellow Flash, That Umbrella Guy. Then later on you had Ethan Van Sciver, comics creator, started talking about this subject. And comic skaters essentially... what the enemies of this consumer revolt called it. They called it Comicsgate because it was supposed to echo Gamergate, because Gamergate was supposedly an uprising of bigotry and hatred of right-wing trolls, where it was nothing of the sort. And you often find amongst the Comicsgaters themselves, they're very diverse, lots of women, so-called minorities. You know, there are some non-white people there. And a lot of people who are of a slightly left-wing outlook. So it's certainly not a right-wing movement. And that became the focus of my discussion as an example of cultural entryism, which I would say is the entry into culture by multiple means in order to effect control, influence, and ultimately destruction, often destruction, of cultural areas which are perceived as valuable to the opponents, which would be, I suppose, the status quo or the majority population or anyone seen as sort of being in the way of progressive politics.
Well, right off the bat there, I mean, at the risk of jumping into deep psychological waters, which you don't really get into in the book, but there's a sort of confusion there of chicken or an egg, or of you know, what's the conscious motives versus the actual results. And what I mean by that is that the justification of the activist to infiltrate culture in order to reconfigure culture as a weapon for social reform would seem to conceal a covert and or unconscious agenda simply to attain power within the culture for themselves.
Yes, and I would say that also you've got lots of... I've thought about the psychology a bit more since finishing the book, and I think that there's a lot of people who are fundamentally dissatisfied, unsatisfied with their lot. They feel like they're owed something, and often this takes the form of a sort of malice or anger, a sense of wanting to take revenge, because of course a lot of progressive politics is to do with, you know, sort of rebalancing power systems as they see it. And so it's about wreaking revenge. And so you often find that you get people going into culture and they're delighting in destroying canon and upsetting fans and erasing sort of 20, 30 years of history more because they want to score points against people who they see as the enemy, who aren't really their enemy. They're just fans who have grown up with something and it's become part of their culture and part of their worldview. And it's part of their history, and that the activists come in and they take over these things, often with an express intent to alter canon, to destroy continuity, to disrupt and take away things. And I think that often it's the product of a sort of a malicious, negative anger towards life in general.
It's kind of a negative identification as well. Getting a stronger sense of identity through an opposition of something. So it's like an adolescent rebellion extended outward into this whole movement even. I'm not familiar with Marxism at all except secondhand. I mean, obviously one can't help but be exposed to it, but I've never studied it. I mean, one of the things I found reading your book that was quite interesting was that sometimes you would lay out the positions of the activists. I don't quite know what word to call. I don't like to group people together as a group, and I know there's this term SJW, but I think it probably doesn't.
I've avoided that term. Yeah,
it tends not to help to label, of course. But on the other hand, there is a phenomenon happening. But anyway, this is a liberal progressive activism that you're describing in the book. A lot of it does come back to Marxist tenets, or at least you trace it back to that, even if many of these people aren't versed in Marxism. They've kind of imbibed by osmosis these values. And you often refer to summations of some of those principles or descriptors of society as a way of explaining the reasoning of the activists. And what I noticed was that I often agree with the tenets that you sum up with Marxism, such as that that the class inequality, really is a powerful dynamic in our society, and it's almost impossible to separate culture and the arts from the influence of the ruling class, for example. That sounds like Marxism. I mean, it is Marxism, but that's something I've found in my own life to be largely true, that we are victimized as individuals and collectively, that there really is an aspect of society and culture that's very abusive, and that does turn us into victims, and so on and so forth. But my point here is that it's quite confusing, but also intriguing, because although I find I often agree with the tenets that seem to be motivating these people, I strongly disagree with the recourses and the actions that they decide are the best response to that situation. So I'm not sure if that's not really a question, but do you know what I mean by that?
Yes, I know what you mean. The collective thing is obviously it's a question, because socially we tend to correct and we can coerce, but obviously it can go even further than that. It can be a sort of oppression. But then this is the result of us being a social species. I think that you've always got a degree of group correction or monitoring. So that's kind of inevitable. I think it would be wrong to see all kinds of responses to group consensus as oppression, which I think that the Marxists or the progressives tend to. So I think there's room for interpretation, and certainly I'm not opposed to the idea of people having equal opportunity, for example, and overcoming the impediments of not having access to good education and good healthcare and so forth. So I'm very sympathetic towards that side. I'm very wary about the idea of enforced outcomes, where you look at people working in industry and you say, well, there's not really enough black people or not enough women. What can we do about it? Well, just let merit take over as far as possible. Try to prevent hiring or discrimination on the grounds of sort of immutable characteristics, and let merit do its work. And unfortunately, you're not going to get an equal or demographic split on the results, because you never do. Look at doctors or lawyers. You're going to have some sort of religious or ethnic bias in there, and you're going to find that in absolutely every area. I looked at various occupations, and most occupations are not 50-50 equal between male and female. So I think that that's something to be aware of, that talent and ability and interest is not equally distributed. So you're just not going to get equal distribution in the results.
Sure. Yeah, well, you were going there also yourself to the solutions or the modes of action, whereas my view is that Marx or whoever really hasn't gone far off. It seems as though the attempt to analyze or examine culture and society and see how it's truly configured, it never goes far enough before the attempt to address the problem and formulate solutions begins. That's my overall sense, and that's why the solutions don't work, because there are these unconscious forces that are causing society to take the form that it takes, and they very much are in all of us, is what I would say. I mean, I don't want to turn this into my polemic, but just I suppose just trying to get a sense of the ground and what would be most productive to talk about. So bringing it back to my initial point was that I don't necessarily disagree with the perspective that liberal progressive activists have on the world, or at least what they're referring to, but as soon as it starts getting turned into action, it seems to become just a perpetuation of the very thing that they're upset about. That's kind of the ironic thing. And so, I mean, one of the things you describe in the book, because you recount, there are many different examples of this dynamic, and I think we're all experiencing it to some degree or another, at least if we do any kind of social networking, that there's a lot of labelling of bullying, for example, on the part of liberal progressives, and yet actually that seems to be their one of the primary modus operandi is bullying. And ditto with hate, like you mentioned, the targeting or the slandering of comic book fans as Ku Klux Klan and as Nazis. And I've experienced that exactly that in my town. I won't go into the details, but on Facebook, just all these hordes of people were calling Christians the equivalent of Ku Klux Klan and Nazis and accusing them of hate. And they were spewing so much hatred in the process. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, it just seemed so incredibly ironic and so unconscious that these people were manifesting the very thing that they were apparently reacting against.
Yeah, I'm always puzzled as to whether or not they know that they are doing this as a tactic. They know that they are bullying. They know that they are being bigots. They know that they are persecuting people. And this is exactly, of course, what they're accusing the other side of doing. And I wonder if they're doing this consciously and they know that this is a hypocritical attitude, or whether they're just not seeing their own behaviour in sort of objective terms.
Yeah. Well,
and I don't have a conclusion. I honestly think it must be often mixed in almost all of them. I think that there are some people at the top who really do understand that they're doing this cynically and that this is purely a tactic. But I think that for many people, it's mixed.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think it's a certain personality type. I think there's narcissism is very strong. And I don't want this to be pointing the finger. As I think it's, you know, this, we all share attributes and qualities, so one can recognize qualities in others because one sees them in oneself. So I'm not saying I don't have narcissistic qualities and tendencies, and that I don't double down and want to get aggressive when someone disagrees with me. I know that within myself. But that's the sense that I get from individuals who are reacting in that way, and that seems entirely blind, that it's just incredibly narcissistic behavior and infantile. There's a very infantile quality to it. So
I think some of that comes from the worldview of the progressive, in that they're social constructivists, that they don't believe that they downgrade agency, so people have relatively little independence or control or responsibility for their actions, that if there's a fault, it's the fault of society, it's the fault of conditioning. So I think that necessarily infantilizes both people and society, because it suggests that people have less control over their actions than more sort of conservative or right-wing people suggest.
Which is again ironic, because one of the things that's being asserted here is their right to agency, their right to take charge of society. So again, wanting to turn the tables in that way. There's a feeling of being powerless and of being subject and stripped of agency by society. The attempt to turn the tables and completely control society.
Even though I would say that a lot of the people who are at the head of this sort of social activists or social justice movement are very privileged. They're white, they're middle class, upper middle class, or they've been privately educated, they've come from a very privileged background, and yet of course they're claiming that they are going to protect the underdog, they're going to protect the minority. And so I think it's almost like a power play. It's sort of, they're saying to the minorities, you back me and I will look after you, you know, we'll take care of you, we'll get sort of affirmative action, we'll get in some quotas to advance you. And it seems like little more than just pork barrel politics, in a way.
What's pork barrel politics?
Well, that's the American system where you have an elected politician, and he arranges funding to suit his voters. So this might not be for the collective good, but it's for the good of a certain constituency which would vote for him. So you know, you might say, well. So for example, my constituency might be university students, so I might say, well, you know, we need more officers enforcing sort of equity and diversity and so forth. So, you know, if you vote for me, I will get you some of that. And I think that a lot of the leaders of the progressive movement there, they're suggesting that people are being done down, that minorities are being done down because they're not perhaps performing especially well, although some minorities outperform, they embarrass people by doing too well, that the Chinese are being sort of, Chinese students were being downgraded in their assessments for Harvard, I think, that there were too many Chinese students, and so the university felt that like it had to impose quotas to stop so many Chinese students doing well and getting into Harvard. The idea is that this progressive movement is often privileged people claiming to be supporters of minorities, and actually they're just asking for minorities to support them socially and politically, and so that they can carry on being privileged leaders, I think.
And you refer to this in a slightly different way in the book, or with another element anyway, where you talk about how some of these activists who are more in the leader position, the way that they assume leadership paradoxically is by taking a submissive position, as in they're identifying themselves, or they're accepting their white privilege, and they're arguing and platforming for the demarginalization of people less privileged, whether it's, you know, homosexuals or people of color, whatever it is, and for their decentrification, and yet they're actually putting themselves in the central role, even while
they describe themselves as being good allies.
Right.
So it's basically is taking the submissive position, but actively still seeking to lead.
Right, and it occurred to me, I haven't thought this through, but that's probably why I have these conversations, just to see if I can make sense of this landscape, that the transgender thing is in a way is even more visibly that, in that you have these men who are identifying as women and thereby taking a submissive position in a certain sense, as in they're submitting their masculinity to femininity, actually trying to become women and identify as women, and yet they're assuming this much higher social status by doing so, to the point that real women, if I can say that, biological women, are being displaced and vilified and whatnot for attempting to assert their own rights as women.
Yeah, so you have this situation. So in the sort of inverted hierarchy, the more oppression that you claim you suffer, the more privileges you should get in return. And so that often with the transgender activists, and I know there are a lot of transgender people who don't engage in activism, they just want to be left alone and they want to live a quiet life, and I can sympathize with that. But there are sort of very vocal activists, often who have not actually fully transitioned, who claim to be victimized. They claim to be sort of subject to prejudice. What they can do is they can go ahead of women, because women are more numerous and they have more services and they're more socially integrated into society. Whereas these transgender activists say, well, you know, we've suffered such a great, for example, you know, we have much greater suicide rates, we have greater rates of depression and so forth. Plus, we've got all these problems of legal recognition and so forth. So therefore, we should be accorded higher victim status and therefore be accorded higher privileges.
Here we go.
Right. And if you're a white man who is in a certain sense the lowest now on this new totem pole, right?
Yes.
Then you can somehow switch it around, but so that you
Get
get
gain
back to the
promotion.
top again. You could, go through the rabbit hole, Alice in Wonderland, and lo and behold, you're back at the top of the totem pole again because now you're a trans woman, and as you say, even without having the surgery, now you can just, in Britain at least, as you know, you can just get an identity card saying you're a woman.
Yeah, so I think that's happened in Canada, and it was certainly proposed in Britain. It's a live topic, and I do feel slightly concerned about because one thing that worries me about the progressives is it's not just a question of toleration and acceptance. Because, for example, I think it's perfectly fair that gay people should not be subject to sort of legal penalties. I think that that the age of consent should be the same for men and women, for heterosexual and homosexual and lesbian and so forth, and that seems perfectly fine and agreeable. I think the problem is with the progressives is that they can never leave it at acceptance or toleration. They have to go for promotion and advocacy, so that what you happen is you can't just be you can't just accept that gay people have their life. Have a right to live their own private lives, and that's fine for them. You have to show that you're actually in favor of homosexuality by giving funding to gay pride parades and sort of and branding on police officers, to sort of say that they're pro-gay and so forth. Well, really, you want your police officers to be absolutely neutral and to enforce the law as neutral as possible. But I think that the problem with progressivism is that it doesn't stop with just accepting; it goes towards promoting and advocacy. So it's not just, oh, we accept that gay people should be equal; we should celebrate them. Instead of not being racist, I'm going to be anti-racist, which is an active thing. Being non-racist is kind of, it's like a passive thing. Being an anti-racist means that you want to show that you're in favor of all races and race mixing and so forth. And this goes into, oh, we're going to promote mass migration, because what's more anti-racist than actually wanting more minorities in your country? Or even, sort of having a majority minority country, as it were. So in every area, it's not just a situation of allowing people to live their lives privately and not interfering with them and removing institutional prejudice against them, but it's actually to do with the promotion of minority positions, which I think is. When it's unthinking, I think that's a slightly worrying situation.
I think it's counterproductive, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, there's no greater way of stoking up racist sentiment than mass migration. Absolutely no better way.
And also with the homosexuality, homophobia thing, like you're saying, that accepting homosexuality as a reality is just part of life and whatever, of course, there's all kinds of different ways it could be explored if it hadn't, that whole thing hadn't been shut down. If when that turns into promoting homosexuality, pro-homosexual cultural indoctrination, then that gives rise, as you said, to a corresponding anti-homophobia, which actually gives rise to homophobia. I mean, homophobia didn't really exist until, or at least the way that it exists now, or is said to exist, as a reaction against the promotion of homosexuality, if you see what I mean. So then somebody who's just kind of more or less neutral to it can start to feel like a homophobe, as you say, because they're not supporting the avocation, and then that actually would create the very, thing that
Yeah,
is.
and I think that and the problem with progressives is that they often encourage activists. They often go straight to the activists and the most extreme activists, and hold these up as the sort of the pioneers. When I think that that's actually not representative of like the majority of these groups. So, for example, you often get sort of progressives saying, oh, isn't it wonderful about the gay pride festivals, which are not just sort of to do with, you know, sort of being proud of who they were and sort of saying, well, we're not going to be afraid anymore, which it was in the early days. And I think that was, you know, it's really heartening to see the early photographs and early film of gay pride parades. But in recent years, it's been sort of leather fetish, and it's so extreme and near nudity and actual nudity. And mm-hmm. and you think, well, this has become a provocation. It's become a situation where you have some extreme activists and extroverts and combining with political activists who are saying, we have the whip hand now. Look at what we're doing in your streets, and you can't do anything about it. And you're funding it. Yeah, the taxpayers are funding it. And I think that drives a lot of sympathetic neutrals away. Unfortunately, I think it's really counterproductive.
Yes, well, it almost seems designed for it. It's bringing to mind the Robert Mapplethorpe, those exhibitions, which would bring me to that the quote that first drew me to your work. So I'll bring that up. Maybe we can get into that and tie these things together. But before I do, I just wanted to mention just a thing, whether you're aware of, that the gay pride actually began in the basement of the London School of Economics. Were you aware of that?
No, I didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah, and so this is, I don't want to hijack this thing because it's my field, but this is something I researched when I ended up writing Vice of Kings, was the way in which the Fabian Society had socially engineered the culture, you know, to such a degree, such a surprising degree, and the London School of Economics was one of their main engines, if you will, and a lot of these liberal progressive movements around, specifically around sexuality, but not only, can be traced to Fabian principles and values. I don't want to get conspiratorial right out the gate, but there's something that you write that was very interesting to me towards the end of the book, which was the difference between tactics and strategies. And you say how, you know, most of these activists, they seem to have tactics that you can recognize, but they don't seem to have strategies. The difference being tactics are particular modes of action that have specific results in the short term, strategies being long term. And so I think there's a spectrum here that potentially can be mapped between, as you say, there are leaders and then there are those who are being led, and the people being led seem to be mostly unconscious of exactly what it is that they're doing and how contradictory what they're doing is, whereas those who are leading might be more cynical and aware, and that would be, you know, where the strategies come in. So I do think there are strategies here, I'll just say that much, that may be long term.
The long term strategy, certainly the founding fathers and mothers, as it were, of the movement certainly had strategic outlooks. For most sort of people on the ground, activists or even sympathizers, it's simply tactics.
Yeah. So anyway, so I'll bring it to this quote, and maybe we can tie it to, say, somebody like Mapplethorpe, and the link between cultural progressivism and sexual progressivism, let's say, or artistic movements and sexual lifestyle movements. The quote was, "The unblinking acceptance of perversity in the most general social sense within the art world is presented as a prerequisite for entry into the cultural elite, distinguishing its members from the common people. Morality is detached from the consumption of cultural artifacts." This is almost a textbook definition of decadence. Now, you also write about decadence in the book for a few pages. This is something that's of great interest to me. I won't take too much time explaining why, but to do with my family background, but also trying to understand the ways in which society is manipulated somewhat from the top down by the use of taboo, and how it seems as though that the ruling classes, the aristocracy, if you will, have a completely different moral value set, A, to the rest of us, and B, to the one that they advocate. So there seems to be a hidden, a secret life of the aristocracy, if you will, the ruling class, which I think is observable through the trends that get incepted into the culture, and then they come into form much later on, including through specifically through artistic movements, I think. So anyway, I don't want to talk too much about my thing. I'd like to hear get your perspective on that. So.
Well, I thought that this would appeal to you, because I do know you've mentioned your brother Sebastian,
yes.
The artist.
So did you know about him before you heard?
I knew of him indirectly. I was sort of on the periphery of the London art scene of the 1990s and the early 2000s. I never met him. I kind of steered clear of private views and parties and so forth, which was very much his field.
Yeah.
But yeah, so something that comes up with decadence is that I have this feeling more and more that elite culture is very much associated with decadence. So you find that decadence is the purview of the flaneur, of the dandy, of the person with money who can engage vicariously with the lower classes and the underclasses, but can just step away because they have this financial independence, and they have, you know, places to go. They have relatives with nice country houses where they can go and recuperate and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that it's interesting to think about the development of elitism as not just a separate value system which is expressed through culture that is different from the mass culture, but it's not just different, it's opposed to, it's actually contradicting the values of the majority.
Right.
So the values of the majority, I would say, so in Britain, for example, which is where we're from, I would say the majority of people are broadly pro-monarchy or largely neutral, whereas the elite are largely anti-monarchy. They're quite strong Republicans, I would say. Also, I would say that the majority of people are sort of broadly sympathetic towards Christianity or neutral. I would say that the upper classes, the elite, are anti-Christian,
mm-hmm.
deliberately anti-Christian.
Right.
The majority of people are broadly in favor of heterosexuality and traditional families, or neutral, or even though they don't always live up to those standards. I would say that the elite is opposed to the traditional family, the nuclear family, towards marriage and so forth. So it's not just a question of the elite developing its own private morality, and which is sometimes different from what it advocates from, but it's actually in defiance of and in outright opposition to the morality and the culture of the majority.
Right.
And so, for example, in politics, I would say you can see this in Brexit. So that the upper class, the cosmopolitan elite, the conspicuous cosmopolitans, were very much in favor of Remain, whereas the majority of people were broadly Brexit, they broadly Leave, or they didn't have a strong feeling either way. So I would say that that's a sort of an example of the way that elitism comes through in politics. And in terms of culture, of course, I mentioned in my review, that was a review of Michel Houellebecq's recent novel on Spiked. And I mentioned in that review, I just had a look at it just to remind myself of what I'd written. And I mentioned that Araki, or for example, Robert Mapplethorpe, who we've already mentioned, they're both examples of decadence. They're both very sexy. They're photographers who take photographs of very sexually explicit images. Mapplethorpe, homosexual, and Araki, heterosexual. Araki was mainly, or does mainly photograph women in his native Japan. Mapplethorpe was photographing gay men in his milieu, which was New York of the 1970s and 80s. And I would say that those are typical examples of the decadence, where it's a sexually explicit, it's pornographic, actually pornographic or borderline pornographic, and it's deliberately in defiance of conventions and taboos. And I would say that these are not only enjoyed by the elite class, by the administrators of the arts and by patrons of the arts, but they're actually promoted, especially if they do upset traditional people. I think that that's part of the attraction of the elite towards decadence is that it actually upsets the majority.
Is it a way of covertly signalling their power, do you think, communicating that they don't obey the rules that they impose upon
the
masses?
Yes, absolutely. I would say that that's one of the key things, is that they're saying they are immune to the degrading effects of decadence. They are able to take it because they are of a higher moral character or social character, or even, you know, if you go into it, sort of biological character, that they are bred to a standard where they have a resilience towards moral decay that the lower classes are not capable of doing.
Right. Picture of Dorian Gray comes to mind.
Yes. Yeah. Shall I read a short passage about decadence?
Sure, yep. Go for it.
Because this is definitely, you know, this is an area I think you've tackled. I don't know your work very well, but I've seen some stuff and I know that this is an area that's good for you. So the decadent is essentially sceptical of the virtues of... Oh, so this is page 102 of Culture War, Art, Identity, Politics and Cultural Entryism. So this is page 102. The decadent is essentially sceptical of the virtues of logic and rationality. He takes pleasure in thwarting or contradicting dominant ideas of progress. He pursues pleasure to a pathological degree. If he is not psychopathic, he venerates the selfishness of the psychopath. He lacks empathy and rectitude. He mocks religion and the pious. He has no respect for authority, loyalty, or sanctity. He dallies in sexual abnormality and subverts gender roles, both partially in a motivation to disconcert others. He enjoys undermining common ideas and standards so long as he reaps vicarious pleasure and suffers few consequences. This is flirtation with nihilism and taking pleasure in destruction. Decadence is pleasure seeking, spurred on by a series of associated egotistical desires, cloaked as moral liberation. But it can only be enacted in an affluent and stable society, sustained by systems working for the benefit of all, which is why decadence is parasitical in nature. Decadence cannot exist in subsistence societies, nomadic societies, and periods of outright catastrophe. Decadence is essentially unproductive, so it cannot exist for an isolated individual or within social units of very restricted size. The decadent is the extreme example of a neophilic inclined leftist in a neophobic inclined conservative society. Is that definition of the decadent not a perfect match with that of a postmodernist theorist or a crusading identitarian living in a stable and prosperous Western democracy?
So do you think then that, I mean, we're sort of loosely mapping the continuum between these elitist value sets of decadence and identity politics, and you just summed it up there. But so, and would you say that postmodernism as a discipline, as an interpretation system that was quite widespread through academia, is a kind of, I'm not sure what term, but do you think it represents the value set of the decadent elite then, postmodernism?
Yes, yeah, I think because it mocks the norms, and for example, it sets itself up to destroy the norms, the standards. So for example, you know, because the idea is that if something, I mean, this is partly Marxism, and I know that Marxism and postmodernism have a fraught relationship and it doesn't always overlap, it sometimes does contradict. But you have this idea that the society is both the Marxist and the postmodernist agree is that society is the result of the conflict between different subsets which are struggling for power, and that it's the majority which tends to have the dominance. So the idea that if a society is mainly white, then it is white people who oppress non-white people. If it's mainly straight society, then it's straight people oppressing the queer people. If it's cisgendered, then it's cisgendered oppressing transgenders and so forth. And so it sets itself up as to be an immediate corollary of decadence, in that it's aiming to subvert the majority. Hmm. That's its overt position is to destabilize, and through destabilizing, to reduce the power of the majority. Although actually, you'll find that there are very many societies where the minority is actually in control, where it's a social or religious group, which is a minority, which is in control. So I think that this idea of Marxism is, and postmodernism, that the majority is always in control, is not strictly speaking true.
I thought Marxism was about the ruling class being in control, which is by definition a minority, surely.
Well, that's true. But you know, what you find is that sort of the cultural analysts have moved away from purely class struggle, and now they've focused on sort of race struggle and sex struggle. You know, the gender divide.
Yeah.
So classical Marxism would say that yes, it's the minority, it's the ruling class who are dominating the other classes. But that interpretation has kind of like gone by the wayside a little.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that. Just staying on postmodernism a bit longer, because I'm sure you do too. Like, I have associates, friends, whatnot, who are trained in postmodernism, or at least sold on it, and kind of advocate it, even if they aren't actually postmodernists. I also have people I speak to who think it's a tool of the devil himself. And I mean, I'm more inclined towards that latter view, but I do like to try and be a bridge between these opposing perspectives. But recently I was talking to John Cusans, and this came up, critical theory particularly came up, and I was talking about postmodernism, as because it's very, very abstract, it has a lot of, or some correlations with the spiritual perspective. And so, like, neti neti is the spiritual path. You know, you identify everything that's false, and when that's gone, whatever's left is real, is true. And also the spiritual perspective essentially is that nothing is true except God. So there are some parallels between postmodernism and this kind of very sweeping and all-encompassing deconstruction or disillusionment process. That make it similar to spirituality, but on the other hand, it seems quite diabolical. So I'm wondering if that's, this is quite a large way of looking at it.
I would say try and find someone who's an expert on Georges Bataille, because Bataille was surrealist. He was a renegade surrealist, and he was very interested in magic and paganism and sacrifice and the role of violence.
Yeah,
and death, and he actually dabbled with the idea of actually doing some human sacrifices back in the 1930s and 40s. Apparently, he was talked out of it. But
apparently, yeah.
I think that gives you an insight into his worldview. But he's been quite an influential thinker on the left. But he's also been taken up by postmodernism, the idea of the art form, the unformed, as was. I'm not expert enough to talk about that, but certainly the sort of flirtation with mysticism. I wouldn't be able to speak with authority on that, but certainly I think there's certainly mileage in that area. I think there's certainly a lot to be said about the crossover between mysticism, esoteric thought, and postmodernism. Yeah.
Well, I know, because Mapplethorpe, one of the pictures, he has the inverted pentagram behind him. I think he maybe was a Satanist, a practicing Satanist, but I can't swear to that. And Foucault has certainly all the earmarks that you're describing here in terms of the convergence between decadism, the sexual decadence, and postmodernism. And he seems to be the poster child of postmodernism pretty much these days, I think. So yeah, my feeling is that it is somehow like a count of it, or an inversion of spirituality for a materialist age.
That links into decadence. I mean, that sounds like a perfect description of decadence, where it's sort of the dabbling in The ideas of sort of suffering and sadism and corruption and undermining norms and actually defying norms, you know, publicly defying norms. That seems an absolute correlation between sort of Satanism and postmodernism. I'm not sure that there's a particularly strong relationship there, but certainly there's an overlap in attitude and psychology, wouldn't you say?
I would, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I wanted to, there's various places I hope to get to today. I want to get to cultural Marxism, but before I do, I wanted to just ask about your point of reference personally, because based, judging by your voice, sounds like me, you're kind of upper middle class, is that right?
Yeah, I was sort of middle class. I've got the received pronunciation of that makes me a social chameleon. So yes, which is quite handy, but obviously it marks you out as a member of the middle class, which I certainly am.
Well, I was going for upper, but so, because I was
Oh,
up.
I fooled you! I fooled
You
you!
did, yeah. Because I'm curious about how much direct experience you feel you have of the secret life of the upper classes. I mean, do you feel that you've had some?
Oh, very little. I mean, I've mixed with them. I've met people who are very privileged, who are definitely upper class. Certainly, I met them at university, and I've sort of met them on occasion since. And working as an artist, some of my collectors certainly would fall into that bracket. But I've never been a part of that myself. My father worked in IT. He did quite well at it, but he certainly wasn't. He didn't come from a sort of upper class background. My mother was a teacher, a school teacher. So I've not sort of got any sort of inherited wealth or anything. So that's why I don't have any personal familial experience. But I have had contact with these people.
Of course, yeah. And in the art world, I mean, you've moved in the art world for some time, haven't you? So that seems that would be frequented by upper middle class people, I
Yes,
presume.
so you get people who were, I mean, it's the pulp song, isn't it? It's common people. It's posh boys and girls slumming it for a little bit at an art college before they go and work with, you know, work in daddy's company, or they go into marketing or advertising or publishing very often.
At the next stop, let me off at the next stop. Life's what's happened on the other side, a sudden moment is passing us by. On the other side, on the other side, let me out at the next stop. Let me out at the next stop. Everybody is heading the same way. Please don't look me straight in the eye. Don't look me straight in the eye. on the other side. A sudden moment is passing us by. On the other side, on the other side, on the other side, on the other side.
Careful about getting conspiratorial with people I've just met, because obviously it's a very thorny thing, and you know, there's all kinds of interpretations that lean towards the conspiratorial, which are very lacking, to put it mildly. But then on the other hand, I think that one can shy away too much from the evidence of intentionality and conscious manipulation in society, because I think it is quite prevalent. So I'm curious, well, maybe this will bring us to cultural Marxism, because this is a trope now and I don't know much about it, but in terms of what we've been talking about today, and let's say specifically like postmodernism as a, I was going to say earlier, Trojan horse for the ideology of the ruling class, but anyway, as some kind of lens that has been introduced into the culture and that has become very prevalent and that does seem to have trickled down from the ruling class and their values in some sense. Do you feel that there is that it has a negative effect? And if so, do you feel that there's a strategy behind that, or is it just this kind of inevitable?
I think it's temperament driven. If you look at the work of Jonathan Haidt and sort of his description of sort of the moral landscape of the sort of the left-leaning person and the right-leaning person, you'll find that he says that, I think it's just a general tendency that you find that people who are left inclined by temperaments, they tend to see sort of boundaries as divisions, as way of preventing the free thought of people, the free thought and free exchange of ideas and so forth. So they see barriers as a problem, as a restriction, as a way of controlling people. Whereas the right sees boundaries as a way of demarcating and protecting. So I think that for the leftist inclined individual, you'll automatically be drawn towards internationalism, globalism, ultimately one world government, but before then multinational companies, transnational organizations, and so forth. So you're naturally inclined to remove those boundaries, whereas the conservative is more inclined to keep those boundaries. And if you're out to destroy boundaries and out to destroy norms, also if you have an automatic sense of solidarity with the underdog, I think you're also going to be on the left, and all of those things on the left would drive you towards postmodernism and its system of values, which is basically that hierarchies are control structures and that they need to be torn down. So I think it's a temperamental thing rather than, and I don't think it's especially directed. I would also say that something like cultural entryism, where we see actually the effect of ideas on people when they go into the cultural industry, I think that it's convergence. It's not collaboration. It's not planned. I think it's just a general people being drawn to certain areas, and they can see people around them who are thinking like them, who have the same vocabulary, who have the same background, who have the same interests, who have the same aims. And they're not coordinating with them. they're just simply working in parallel with them, because they simply have these automatic sense of assumptions, sets of assumptions. And I think that that tends to align them together. So I don't think it's much, I would say the majority is not just conspiracy, it's sort of just convergence.
Well, so that could be technically true without being actually true, in the sense that if there was a ruling class that had some long-term strategies of social engineering, they would still by definition be the minority, and the majority who are being mobilized by that sort of living propaganda would still be the majority, and they would be acting as you're saying, but that wouldn't rule out that there was a top-down influence, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, that the theorists of postmodernism were all highly educated, they're all middle class or upper class. You know, many of the writers admired, you know, for example, Desaad, is obviously a member of the gentry or aristocracy. No, it's aristocracy. Even.
Hmm.
I certainly you could see that the leading thinkers and maybe the leading promoters certainly are in positions of power, and you could describe them as upper class. You know.
Are you familiar much with the Fabian Society and their influence?
No, I heard you talking about this. I think it was with Benjamin Boyce, and you were talking about how your family was involved in the Fabian Society, and that they were promoting progressive values, but they were doing it in a sort of by subterfuge. They were getting involved in all sorts of organizations that were not ostensibly to do with politics, but they could add their ideology to all sorts of different areas, which I guess is a form of cultural entryism or political entryism.
Yes, it did remind me of that when I was reading your description. It reminded me of exactly of the Fabian methodology, which is they call themselves permeators. So they just found different ways to permeate different stratas of society, and particularly attempting to influence the rich and the powerful, not that they went themselves, but extending that reach by any means necessary. And it's a question that should remain open whether that could be called conspiratorial, because conspiracy implies secrecy and criminality. And much of what the Fabian Society did, including starting the Labour Party, to just use the most obvious, broad example, is there was nothing secret and there was nothing criminal about it, actually. But in terms of a very small group or groups of people who have long-term social engineering goals and go about them in a way that's devious, I guess that's where it's not necessarily criminal, but it's definitely quite devious, the wolf in sheep's clothing, of course.
What's your view of it, of Extinction Rebellion?
Well, not good. I mean, I just watched a documentary about them, and so I wouldn't feel very qualified to talk about them. But just very much as I would say that they give me a sense of an example of something like what I observed with the Fabian Society, how they would. If they had a long-term goal, then they would work backwards from that goal and think, like, what steps would we need to bring about within society in order to end here? And then from there, then they would, I think, I mean, I am filling in some gaps here, they would formulate ideologies and value sets that would then, they could then imbue the culture with and thereby infect individuals with, that over generations they would end up acting in this way. Now, I know that does sound very broad conspiracy theory. I'm aware that one can easily get pulled into it when one's trying to sum up something. But
it sounds like politics to me.
Okay, well, there you go. So, so that's fine, yeah. But yeah. It's funny how the two can be confused.
They overlap, yeah.
Well, they do, and
it's political strategic thinking is basically what you're talking about.
Absolutely. And you know, Adam Curtis has, you know, made documentaries about this, which are by the BBC. I mean, they're not considered controversial particularly. So it really depends how one frames it, and you know, whether one can resist the urge to jump to conclusions or start scapegoating or panicking or, and the rest of it. Because it may just be, yeah, the way that society has always kind of evolved is there are these... I mean, it's a combination of top-down manipulations with bottom-up movements, but I think that the further we've evolved or degenerated, the less grassrootsy or the less organic or spontaneous the bottom-up movements are. So I'd say that Extinction Rebellion is an example of that, of you know, a generation that's been so thoroughly propagandized that it's now dancing to a tune that it's no idea well, you know, who wrote it.
I think the Extinction Rebellion thing is that you look into their founding principles, and their founding principles are to do with socialism or communism, that it's sort of revenge on the West for colonialism and so forth, and they talk about sexual politics matters and stuff, and they I think they've said privately that they're quite explicitly using the environment as a Trojan horse, because they know that this is something that people are quite worried about, and it is easy to mobilize large groups of people who are concerned about the environment, and to use that in order to remove what they see as the sort of the ineffective and illegitimate fake democracy of the West, and replace it with sort of councils. They were sort of having people's councils, it was called, or something quite sinister. When I was looking at Extinction Rebellion, it seemed like it was very it paralleled the Fabian Society. It also paralleled some of the stuff that I was seeing in culture, although not quite as strong in culture.
So tell me what you know about and what your opinion is on cultural Marxism then, because that's something that's more or less been branded a conspiracy theory, and I don't know enough about it. All I've picked up was the Frankfurt School sounds quite similar to the things I discovered around the Fabian Society and London School of Economics and whatnot. It sounded like it was almost the same blueprint, so I'm inclined to think that there's probably something in it, but I don't know the ins and outs, and I know that it's generally been branded as a sort of right-wing meme/conspiracy theory, and yet it does seem as though there are things in your book that are congruent with that theory. So what's your position on cultural Marxism as an idea?
You have to be. I don't use the phrase cultural Marxism in the book, but one of the reasons is that cultural Bolshevism was a phrase that was used by the Nazis in the 1920s and 30s. So cultural Bolshevism is I wouldn't say it's a code word, but it's certainly terminology which was used by the Nazis, which has sometimes been mistakenly linked to cultural Marxism. I would say that the critical theory, which comes from the Frankfurt School, which is Adorno and the rest of that group, Horkheimer and so forth, not Gramsci, but Gramsci is sort of like associated with the sort of anarchist socialist analysis of culture. A critical theory is definitely derived from Marxism. I mean, it was explicitly a Marxist cultural critique of late capitalism, which was clearly set out again and again. And that seems to conform to what we might loosely call cultural Marxism. Critical theory has had huge reach in the academies. It's sort of absolutely dominated the arts fields. Certainly, if you're involved in art criticism, it's pretty much a prerequisite that you understand the Frankfurt School and critical theory, and that has it's almost completely taken over the English schools in universities, the English faculties, that English is now political, so such that in English is a political discipline. Harold Bloom was complaining about this in the 1980s, and this seems to be something that it was held in abeyance for a bit. I think in the 1990s it was sort of held in check, but then I think, you know, in the 2000s it's really taken off because it's become allied to and promoting identity politics, specifically identity politics of minority groups and so forth. So cultural Marxism, I wouldn't use the expression, but I think basically what it does is running parallel to postmodernism, which is something different, but they often come to the same conclusions and they often use the same tactics. So the conclusions are to do with power dynamics, and the tactics are to do with destroying power dynamics, destroying majorities, undermining majorities, undermining the idea of objective reason, facts, and so forth, and the scientific method, saying that the scientific method is a product of the majority, the political majority, and that this is not, this is an enforced consensus, and all consensuses are actually the result of oppression. That sounds like a description of cultural Marxism, and it also sounds like a description of critical theory. It also is largely congruent with postmodernism. So, yeah, I think it exists, although I wouldn't use that term.
Right, for obvious reasons. So what do they want to replace facts with then, would you say? Feelings? I mean, that's clear in identity politics, but...
Well, I don't know. I mean, there is this idea I was reading, for my sins, I was reading some feminist theory, and there's something called the Xenofeminist Manifesto, which is intersectional feminism, fourth wave feminism. Mm-hmm. And it's basically saying that there is no such thing as sex, there is no such thing as gender. And what we will do is we will destroy the concept of gender and destroy the concept of sex, of biological sex, mm-hmm. so that there is nothing left. And in this sort of floating potpourri, we'll be able to choose and to select what best fits our identity on a particular day, and it's all fluid and it can change. But I don't know what the end game is. Their end game is enforced atomization. Mm-hmm. It's enforced. It's that there will be no set genders. There will be no set gender roles. There is no such thing as biological sex. And we will enforce this. So I think it's basically a system that you'll have an elite group, again, you'll have an elite group which is enforcing confusion. Mm-hmm. I can't see a way of this system working unless it's artificially maintained by an elite, imposing it on the majority who really don't understand it and don't believe it and don't think it's workable.
Well, wouldn't it be algorithm run, essentially? So you don't have to make any decisions because now you've got no sense of who you are from one moment to the next. But if you just take the implant in your brain, then our algorithms will tell you what to do.
Yes, welcome to the dystopia of our intersectional future, Jason. Oh, God.
Yes, it is terrifying, but also fascinating. And as I said, it does seem to be a mappable strategy behind all this.
I was reading Judith Butler for my sins. Again, this was related to the same project. And you know, Judith Butler is the woman who thinks that gender is performed. It's not an assigned. It's not an immutable characteristic. It's performative. Mm-hmm. And so she wrote this book, the famous book, whatever it was, that I can't remember the name of. But she wrote in the new edition, which I read, she wrote a little bit about her background. And it sounded like she grew up as a lesbian in some like rural Ohio or something. And she had a very unhappy time. And it's clear that a lot of her motivation for destroying the idea of gender and destroying the idea of sex as being a sort of a bilateral, a binary system, is clearly to do with her own personal unhappiness. And you think, well, you know, I'm really sorry for it. It must have been miserable. But I think that making everyone confused and angry is going to make a lot more people miserable. I don't think it's going to make people happy. Because you look at some of the gender activists, they're not happy people. They are not content. And they let you know that they're not content, and they're trying to make as many other people uncontent as possible.
Misery loves company, yeah.
Yeah, malcontents.
Have you read?
I feel a lot of sympathy towards her personally, but I think that she's made a daft move, and I don't think our ideas hold water. Not enough water to be taken very seriously.
Hmm. I guess it's in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed people rule. Have you read much of Bertrand Russell in your time?
I have. I've read a few of his. I read his sort of outline of Western philosophy, or whatever it was, his general book. Not much specific. Did you have anything in mind?
Well, in Vice of Kings, which is in some sense it's really sort of, obviously not a superficial work, because I'm trying to get to the depths of the depravity of human society, but I have to touch quite lightly on the subject matter, because it would have taken 20 years otherwise to research. So I just did some very cursory. I was just following this microchip deal, or there were a number of them. One of them was Jimmy Savile, so I was trying to trace the ways in which organised child abuse and trafficking that became visible via Jimmy Savile and the Islington care homes and stuff in the 2000s or the 2010s, how that converged with social engineering and, you know, deep state, to use that term, manipulations and stuff, because it seemed like it did, like he was protected on these very high levels. So that was one of the eels. And another was the Fabian Society, obviously, and then my own family. And my grandfather corresponded with Bertrand Russell. They didn't really know each other, but he was, Bertrand Russell obviously was very active and very influential. And though he wasn't a Fabian, he moved in the same circles, and he seemed to have the same value set and the same aims.
So he was deeply involved in CND, wasn't he?
Yes. So my grandfather was one of the founding members. In fact, he designed the symbol of the CND, or co-designed. I don't actually know the full details, but he was very active in that regard, and so I grew up on the periphery of this, so hence my, you know, my need to try and understand it better. So I'd never read Bertrand Russell anyway, but one of the things, you know, when I did read some of him, as you know, he had one of his books, The Scientific Outlook. He had this goal of achieving a totally scientifically engineered society, which is, you sum up in your book, that's very central to socialism, this idea of a scientifically managed society. And yet his descriptions are quite dystopian. And it's interesting because he seemed to present them as cautionary, in the same, similar to how Huxley wrote Brave New World, but actually Huxley was a eugenicist, and Huxley, his values did seem to coincide with the kind of world that he seemed to be warning against. He actually seemed to be more instrumental with bringing it about. So something like Brave New World could be seen as a blueprint disguised as a cautionary fable, if you want to go there. With Russell, it was somewhat similar, I think. That his books describe exactly how to create this scientific dictatorship, while at the same time a line here and a line there warning against it. But a bit later on, or in another book, he's quite overt, and he says outright, yes, this does sound terrible, but this is absolutely necessary. If man is ever going to be free, he first has to be completely scientifically indoctrinated and reconditioned so that he knows what to do with his freedom. So he essentially prescribed several centuries of scientific dictatorship dystopia, at the end of which man could finally be set free, I guess, once he was microchipped and all the rest of it. But anyway, I just bring it up because one of the correlations I make in the book is between, it happened organically, because again, I found out my grandfather was friends with William Empson, I think his name was, one of the leading, of critical theory. And so I looked into critical theory, and I saw there were a lot of parallels between Russell's scientific society and critical theory, in the sense it's all about breaking things down into measurable components or compartments so that it can then be manipulated so that one can objectively understand art or objectively direct society and human beings. So there seems to be that convergence there. And one of the things I wonder, you know, at a broader level, like how much was critical theory, again, like I said about postmodernism, was it designed as or just organically turned out to be a kind of Trojan horse to infiltrate us psychologically, to cause us to conform to particular ways of thinking that would then make us easier to program? I mean, program in quotes.
I would say yes. Well, because critical theory was directed towards understanding and combating why socialism had not taken hold in industrial Western societies. So it was deliberately aimed as a critique to explain why late stage capitalism had not evolved, as they would see it, in the inevitable move towards socialism and then communism. So it was quite deliberately, it was a diagnostic tool, and it was also a means of combating democracy and capitalism, which is sort of, it springs from the logic of Marxism. And so that was how critical theory was developed. I'd also say, it's for anyone who's interested in this subject that you talk about Russell and so forth, I'd say also take a look at H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
Because H.G. Wells was very involved. He was a socialist. He was an ardent anti-theist. He was an advocate of science. He did actually train as a scientist, and he was a science teacher before his writing took off and he became independent. His first book was actually a science textbook before he became involved in the scientific romance, which we call science fiction. And he was closely allied. He was very interested in eugenics and so forth. And he flirted with it in a book called Anticipations, which I believe was published in 1901. I knew all about this before, but I was recently reading a book for review, which was a survey of H.G. Wells's career. That review, my review, is going to appear on spiked-online.com, which is where you can find many of my articles, including the Welbeck review that we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And the H.G. Wells things is interesting because it shows how the sort of the controlling authoritarian side combines with the scientific materialist side, which combines with the anti-religious side, which inevitably leads to things like the flirtation with eugenics and sort of the scientific fashioning of man. And so, for example, you've got to remember that the idea of the Soviet new man was essentially a recreation, a shaping humanity freed from his previous restrictions and allowing him to reach his full capacity as a social being. And this would include sort of removing the family, removing constraints of inheritance, removing constraints of property, because of course property is unequally distributed, and so if you get rid of all property or private property at least, then you can sort of free up people. So this ties in with H.G. Wells and Huxley and so forth. Yeah.
Just
I do write about H.G. Wells. He was he's not exactly a Fabian, or he was, and then he left. But anyway, again, very, very closely.
But he was definitely, he was an internationalist, he was a globalist, he was in favour of one world government.
Yes, and the famous book, The Open Conspiracy, maps out quite a lot of his vision in a similar way to Bertrand Russell, although he wasn't as open about how dystopian this future was, I don't think, as Russell was. It occurred to me, I mean, it hadn't occurred to me before, I'm just wondering if it's occurred to you, that as regards eugenics, which of course has a very bad rep now since the Nazis, that whole thing, I mean, nobody could openly advocate eugenics at this point and get away with it, I don't suppose. But the one side effect, anyway, of transgender is a kind of a crypto-eugenics program.
Yeah, yes, this has been mentioned by... That's why that we have now have this split between the LGB movement and the T. They've sort of separated themselves from the transsexuals because there is this issue of young children who were showing signs of homosexuality, or, you know, being gay or queer or a lesbian, and then being diagnosed as transgender, and therefore being offered counselling and hormone therapy and eventually surgery.
Yeah.
In order to allow them to become the gender they want to be, which is clearly it's antithetical to the idea of sexual expression, freedom of sexual expression, which I think that the LGB movement was initially. So there's this division between so it's this idea of taking away the possibility of being gay or being lesbian by actually intervening early on and saying, well, actually, you're not the gender you think you are. You're a different gender. And I know that people like Douglas Murray in his new book, who is himself gay, he talks about, you know, that there's this slightly sinister quality that it's it seems like a covert way of erasing homosexuals and lesbians, or potential homosexuals and lesbians, from the population by assigning them new genders.
Well, apparently it's very big in Iran, for example, transgenderism, because homosexuality is not acceptable. So then, that's a way to fix homosexuality.
Yes, so though you're not really gay, you're just you're actually a woman. so that's the solution to that problem. And yes, and so it's basically either have a sex change or face the possibility of a death sentence.
Yeah. Also, Extinction Rebellion. I mean, I don't know how much they've talked about having their tubes tied and so forth, these activists, but certainly they're advocating against having children. So that's
They're definitely Malthusians, aren't they?
Yeah. So it would seem as though, yeah, eugenics has a new life, a new lease of life, just in this very concealed fashion.
Yeah, so that's quite interesting, yes, because there's the self-sterilization, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because if transgender people generally, I mean, if they actually go through with the surgery, or even if they just go through with the extended periods of hormone treatment, they become infertile. And of course, a lot of the elites who are ardent environmentalists are basically advocating against not having children or not having white children, you know.
Right.
Because there's this anti-white sentiment amongst Western elite upper class environmentalists, because there's this strong feeling that it's inherent in white people that they're going to destroy everything, they're going to invade other cultures, they just take, they're terrible people and so forth. So there's this implicit aversion to seeing Western society sustained in the manner that it is at the moment by discouraging people, Europeans, from having children, and encouraging transgenderism. It's a very sort of mixed up situation.
That's one thing that seemed particularly bizarre as a contradiction. I mean, so much of the not just Extinction Rebellion, but people who are worried about climate change, they don't seem to be too bothered about 5G, about the Internet of Things, about using their smartphones, about, you know, the technological infiltration of our psyches and our nervous systems. That none of that seems to be a problem, relatively to many of these people. And I don't know, how familiar are you with transhumanism as a movement?
Not very, but I could imagine where they're coming from, but I don't know anything about them specifically.
Well, it converges observably and directly with identity politics, because I'm sure you can imagine they're advocating, a self that exists independently of biology. They're talking about this Beeman, which is basically just the composite or the congregation of your different likes and dislikes on Facebook, basically, yeah. You know, your preferences and so on. And that discrete self, which exists outside of biology, can then be uploaded into the cloud and so on. And so part one of the, again, it's
that sounds dangerously insecure.
It does sound... Yeah, well, we can't trust the ecosystem, so let's create our own.
Out of silicon and copper and fiber optics, though, that sounds good. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and based on the idea that somehow it can create something that will be stable independently of the ecosystem, I presume. I mean, that's the idea. Well, I think that it converges with colonizing other planets. And downloading, putting our or sending our consciousness to robot drone droids that are on Mars and things of that kind. So anyway, quite a far-reaching science fiction vision worthy of H.G. Wells. I doubt if it has any reality to it personally or any future, but
it is definitely an extension of those ideas of a transracial human race. Which is sort of, you know, post ethnicity, post nationhood, post religion,
post gender,
post biological procreation,
and it does. I mean, to bring it all the way around back to psychology, narcissism coming to mind, like he's gazing at his reflection and in love with his reflection, that could even be said to symbolize like a desire to be made of water, to be outside of the body, to be existing just as an image. I think there is that quality to narcissism, or it converges with this kind of mass movement that, as you were saying about this author, I forget her name, but the one who was very unhappy in her own...
Judith Butler.
I think the more unhappy we are in our bodies, the more we want to dissociate into some fantasy realm where we don't have to feel the pain and the shame and the suffering of that's been put in our bodies, the more inclined we are to create this supposed utopia, which is at the physical level is a dystopia. You have to be completely divorced from facts and physical reality in order to believe in the reality of it and be safe from the suffering and the anguish that has driven you into these utopian schemes to begin with. So I think we're seeing something.
I think that also lines up with a lot of religious thought, the shunning of the body, the shunning of temptation and so forth, the ascetic life, and of detaching yourself from the body. And I remember reading a bit about Buddhism, and they have this expression, the cage of bone and the mud of flesh. There's actually an abhorrence of the body, of the senses, of the bodily functions, and there's real fear about that. And that's interesting, because it also lines up with the very, very materialistic, scientific, you might even say autistic view of the absolute materialists, the anti-theists, the scientists, the people who want society modeled along scientific lines. And they also have a kind of an abhorrence of sensuality and bodily functions as well. So it's interesting that there are some parallels.
Yeah, that was my departure point with Prisoner Infinity, actually, which is very much about these subjects, and was this was recognizing that there was a, and the New Age movement specifically, like the Aquarian Conspiracy, you could see it almost as an updating of Wells's The Open Conspiracy in its intent anyway, that the New Age movement, one of the tenets of it, and of this kind of quasi-quantum spirituality, whatever we're going to call it, is the divorcing of spirituality from eros. So it's a sexless spirituality, and which it says in common with, I'd say, distorted religion, like, again.
Well, Heaven's Gate.
Yeah, yeah.
You know about Heaven's Gate, where this cult, and they basically sterilise themselves.
Yeah, castrated, even, in order to jump aboard the comet.
Yeah, yes, that's it, actually castrated them.
Yeah, yeah, that's a microcosm. Yeah. So, bringing it down, because we might, you know, we're not going to come up with a solution to this vision that we've been sharing today. So, bringing it back to the everyday and mundane. How are you situated in this landscape as a writer and as an artist who is attempting to address? Well, the things we've been talking about. Are you experiencing a lot of support? Do you feel that you have solidarity of individuals out there, or are you getting some blowback, some backlash? How's it going?
It's a mixture. It's a mixture of people being very supportive in private and getting very little support in public. Because I often get emails and messages saying, "Oh no, I read your book. I read Culture War, and it's really saying what I wanted to say, but I didn't feel brave enough to say it." And I completely agree with you, but there's a thing against identity politics at the back of the book, which was published, and it was signed by a number of people. Mm-hmm. A number of people have said to me, I wish I could sign it. I absolutely believe in these principles that you're talking about, but I can't do it because I work in the arts, because I've got a mortgage to pay, because, you know, I've got to think about my promotion, and anything that comes out in support of your view is liable to be mischaracterized as bigoted. It's just simply the reason you hate quotas is not because you've got a principled objection to all quotas. It's because you're a sexist or a racist or a bigot or a transphobe or Islamophobe or whatever, or an anti-Semite or whatever, you know, that just whatever insults happens to come to hand. So, I mean, I'm relatively lucky that there are a number of outlets which are very supportive of my writing. So I write for Spiked Online. I also write for The Critic. I write for The Jackdaw, which is an independent newsletter on the arts, on the fine arts, which is very good. The print version is better. That has more material than the online website. So I get my work out. I currently have a second book which is in publication limbo, which I don't want to talk about it, but I mean, if it comes out, then I would definitely like to talk to you again about it, because I think you'd be interested.
So you said you don't want to talk about it, but are you having problems finding a publisher because of the content?
Yes.
Right.
Because it's not so much the content, it's the approach. It's because I'm skeptical about one aspect of identity politics, which is widely accepted, and I'm critical of it to a degree. But anyway, I mean, it's not entirely that. It's also the size. It's also the parameters. It's also the fact that I'm not an academic. I'm an independent writer. So I can't sort of wave my university credentials and get an academic publisher on board. So this makes things difficult. And also, I mean, I do know that certain doors have been closed to me, but I don't want to say anything publicly, because it's kind of, I don't want to put anyone on the spot.
I was going to ask if you felt there'd been any consequences. So there's been that kind of consequences. Have there been the more proactive kind that you've been attacked?
Well, I think that it may have had a knock-on effect onto my art career. Because although I'm a writer, I'm also an artist. I've exhibited a lot. I've sold a fair amount. There are works of mine in museums and so forth. I feel that my reaction to the book may have had a knock-on effect that it's discouraged curators and museum directors and so forth from programming my work. And they had previously programmed my work.
Mm.
I've not had anything cancelled. But I've just not had any recent inquiries meeting any success. So this may be because of my because I've sort of come out against identity politics and progressivism, or I've certainly been very critical of it. Or it may be that my work is just not particularly fashionable or appealing, or it could be that I don't meet their quota targets
of,
at the moment
for diversity.
Yes.
Quota.
Because I am white and I am male and I am straight.
Right.
So I tick all the boxes. Yes, I'm at the bottom of the hierarchy. Yeah. But my art itself is actually apolitical. My art has got no political connotations at all. So
that's bad too, then.
Yes. If it was left wing art, then I think it would get a showing. But it's not. It's not right wing art by any means. It's sort of it's very neutral.
Mm.
In political terms.
Right. So.
I think that's the art career has been a collateral damage of taking the political position that I have.
And do you think it's because people have read your book, or do you think it's because did your book get sufficient publicity that they were alerted, or they just do a background check and they read the summation?
I think it's just rumor and background check. I'm sure that some of them I'm sure, you know, the bigger institutions have bought copies, or not that the bigger institutions were going to do anything with my work anyway. I mean, the Tate was, you know, in a way, you know, the Whitechapel was never going to do a retrospective of me. The Tate Gallery was not going to buy any pictures by me. The British Council wasn't going to organise a touring exhibition of America of my work. So they haven't taken away anything that they were going to give me anyway. I failed on many, many criteria, and this was just an extra one. But I do think that maybe just a few, there have been a few background emails, someone saying, oh, you know this guy, he's been quite critical of feminism. Or did you know this guy was not particularly sympathetic towards the case for reparations? Or he's been sort of... He's a free speech advocate, so therefore, you know, that's basically he's dog whistle for far right. You know, I think that these background stuff like that that may have tipped a few editors or venue administrators against me without them actually having read the text.
Right, the climate of fear in which.
Mm. Oh, it absolutely exists. I've been told by people in person who are in the art world that they can't talk about certain things.
But isn't it somewhat self-fulfilling? I mean, I'm thinking of these people who are hearing about you and then they're deciding, oh, I'm not going to take a risk. Mm. But based on just because the person who told them, hey, watch out, this guy, they're also afraid. So they feel like, right?
Yeah, it's a culture of silence. It's also a denunciation culture. Where, you know, especially not so much in the fine art world, but certainly in Twitter, for example, that you get sort of social kudos for calling out Nazis or calling out, and they don't have to be Nazis, they just happen to be people you disagree with. And if you can get, you know, like half a dozen people or a dozen people to dogpile onto your subject, then, ooh, you know, you've metaphorically speaking, you've punched a Nazi. So it doesn't happen out. I mean, the fine art world is a little bit more discreet, you know,
mm-hmm.
indirect, but that's the sort of thing that happens. And yes, it does sustain the culture of silence, because they see someone putting their head up and they say, oh, you know what happened to him? He lost his reviewing job at the so-and-so journal. And he never exhibited again after publishing that article or that letter. And that's how the culture of silence is maintained.
Yeah, well, I have a similar situation to you, it sounds like, superficially at least. I got a book that I've written which I thought would be easy to publish, or relatively, but I was very naive. It's about Hollywood.
Well, you're going up some against some big entrenched interests.
Exactly. Interesting you mentioned academic, because I have approached a couple of academic, because I can't find a mainstream. I don't really like academic because they charge so much. But
yes.
But I never even went to college. So it's interesting in that, because I have been published twice by academic presses, but I don't have any. I've got anti-academic credentials, like I'm a dropout. So I don't know what that speaks to exactly, but I guess if it's not too contentious, I mean, those earlier books, they were film books as opposed to social, social exposés or what have you.
There's certainly a market for sort of niche subjects, especially if you're a specialist in an area, you have a good reputation, then not having an academic background is not a bar to getting published by an academic press.
Right.
But certainly if you're taking on some sort of social or cultural issues that are controversial, and you're taking, ironically enough, a minority position against the consensus, then suddenly your lack of academic credentials suddenly becomes a deal breaker, interestingly.
Right. And how much does getting peer? Because one of the things a publisher asked me when I was proposing was, well, one of their criteria is five academic peer reviewers, yes. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've had the same. They say, can you give five academic, well-respected academic peers to peer review this? And I gave them three or four, and I said, I can find others if you want.
Yeah.
And you have to be very careful, because you can't just name famous people. These have to be people you probably had some sort of contact with, and you really hope that they're very sympathetic towards you.
Yeah.
Because all the publisher needs is just, a little bit of doubt from one of those reviewers, and it's suddenly, oh, okay, we can't take this on. They're looking, the publishers are looking for a reason not to take it on, especially if they think it's not going to be a big seller. They prefer just not to have to deal with the controversy.
Yeah, although controversy usually helps sales. So, I mean...
Yes, except, of course, then the whispering campaigns. The so-and-so publishers, they published that book by that famous, neo-Nazi called Jason Hawley or Alexander Adams or something.
I'm glad you got my name wrong there, because we have it on record.
Oh, no. What is it?
Horsley with an S.
Horsley. Yeah. Yes, my apologies, Jason. Sorry.
No, it was an appropriate moment to misname me, definitely.
yeah, absolutely. He's a terrible Nazi, he is. Not you.
Yeah, well, I found for myself that the worst they can do is ignore you, and that's mostly what they've done with me. Like, I have managed to get the last two books were particularly challenging, not necessarily to identity politics, and not necessarily in the way that I would get blacklisted as a Nazi, although I've written about transgender at my site, which did get me a bit blacklisted, I know, but my books are more about, they're more wide, the lens is wider, but I know that the people who they're kind of addressing in a certain sense, like a book about occultism and organized child abuse, is not being read or reviewed by people who are interested in occultism. My book Prisoner Infinity about UFOs and social engineering around that whole thing, the New Age movement and transhumanism, isn't really getting noticed because people are invested in these narratives. So I think that's probably the central thing that one is up against. If one is challenging a narrative that people are invested in and have invested years of their lives, even if it's not literally that their jobs depend on it, it's like their sanity depends on it to some extent. So yeah, they tend to be just ignored. I mean, I don't know if I consider myself lucky to be ignored, because at least I haven't been tarred and feathered as yet, which is quite miraculous. But on the other hand, sometimes it feels like it would be better to be attacked than to be ignored. So
Well, we shall see what the response is to this interview.
I think it'll be fine, because I've got my horticulture, my own self-made culture realm, and it's all friendly people. I think that's actually one of the things I've been unconsciously doing, is I've been creating a filter it with my work, so that only people who can really discern the nuance can even make it through. So actually, I don't have many people who are into conspiracy theory, particularly. Well, I do have a bunch of those people, but they're definitely the cream of the crop, if you see what I mean. I think there's a natural selection process. Not that I'm a Darwinist, but in
Or
terms
an
of,
elitist.
well, yeah, of course, that's one way of looking at it. But on the other hand, I am quite democratic. I mean, I try to reach everyone. I try to communicate in such a way that will reach everyone, but I always fail. So,
Yeah, that's one of the important things. When I was writing the book, I wanted to write it in a way that was jargon-free, so that anyone could pick this up and, if they've got a fairly reasonable level of engagement and education, that they can read it through, and it's fairly clearly explained, and that they can sort of hold this book out to a, they can give this book to a friend and say, oh, you might like this or that chapter, because it discusses different subjects. So, or I really enjoyed the chapter on feminism, or really enjoyed the chapter on Comicsgate, for example,
Well, I have a friend of a friend of my wife, who is very immersed in identity politics, and I always hear about her opinions from my wife, because I don't hang out with her myself, and I always find myself getting exasperated with this person that I'm not even hanging out with. I quite like her when I do meet her, but her opinions are very entrenched in identity politics. And I found myself, while I was reading my book, thinking, oh, I should give this book to her, but then I realized that it would be futile, because apart from anything else, it's written by a white man, so she has this capacity to dismiss anything
I feel
on
like
those grounds.
I should have used a pseudonym with a nice ethnic name. Oh
Yeah,
well.
a little picture of
But then, as soon as you're exposed, you're completely discredited because you've misrepresented yourself. So maybe that's a bad idea.
Well, except you can say, I'm sorry, but I do identify as a black lesbian, and that's my right.
Just so long as you don't identify with Jason Hawley, without an S, who's a definite neo-Nazi.
Yes. I wanted to read one line just before we end that I loved, as a bit of humour and informative. You said, many administrators, curators, tutors, and scholars are women in the arts world. In my experience, lower and middle ranks of arts administration are hugely dominated by women who are rapidly rising to top positions. Of the journals I write for, half have female editors. Every single editorial assistant is female. The staffs of publishing house press departments are almost all female. Roughly 90% of the museum press officers I have liaised with are female. I would love to meet a cast of oppressive bearded patriarchs in the arts, so I could gaze upon them in wonder and curiosity. I could shake their hands and wish them farewell.
Thank you very much. That's you've got the best of me there. Thank you.
Changes in the heart, change within the times, strangers in the night.
There ends my conversation with Alexander Adams. For more information on Alexander's art and writing, you can click on the various links in the show notes. By the time you hear this, I will be back from my trip to Europe, God willing, and ready to re-embark on the next phase of my existence. The next podcast that I've got lined up is with Daniel Miller, who hopefully I had a very interesting evening presentation kind of event with. Okay, that's it. This is The Limitless, the podcast between.
Changes in the heart, changes in the time, strangers in the night, pass up and downtown. Changes
with the night. Strangers in the heart, stay up until light. Dangers in your soul, they motion to the stars. Changes